Reed, have you heard of this term called drunkenim?
I'm not even sure what you just said, so no.
Drunkenim, which is basically the assertion that any word in the English language can be used as a synonym for getting drunk.
Oh, okay. I have not heard of this, no.
It was popularized by a British comedian. His name is Michael McIntyre. He was just using terms like, I was utterly gazeboed, or I'm going to go and get totally and utterly car parked.
It does kind of work.
So much so that two German linguists, of course the Germans, decided to actually do a study, and they published a new paper in the Yearbook of the German Cognitive Linguistic Association, which included an extensive appendix of 546 English synonyms for the word drunk.
Well, I do feel like I'm moving a little slow today because I felt like I boiled the ocean last night.
Welcome to Touchpoint, a podcast dedicated to discussions on digital marketing and patient engagement strategies for hospitals, health systems, and physician practices. In this podcast, we'll dive deep into digital tools, solutions, and strategies that are impacting our industry today. We hope to share a lot of great information with you and have fun along the way. Thanks for joining us. Now, here are your hosts.
Welcome to episode number 376 of Touchpoint. Chris Boyer, Reed Smith, here as always.
Here as always, recording the podcast, if you get my drift.
Recording the podcast. Is this kind of like how college towns all have a bar called the library? So that's people right. can say that they were at the library last night?
That's exactly right. We were just behind the microphone.
Good stuff. Well, thanks everybody for tuning in for another week of Touchpoint. We certainly appreciate the support. Again, quick plug for the website, touchpoint.health. Hope we see you here in just a few short weeks in Viva Las Vegas for the Healthcare Marketing Physician Strategy Summit. We'll mention it again here at the end. The reason I bring that up, however, there is something called the TPS report. Many of you have heard about it. Many of you have signed up for it. But if you check it out over on the website, it's a simple email to get your week started, 5 articles, and a couple of links in there to some industry conferences and educational events, things like that. We'll pause here, let you go sign up for that, talk more about the conference towards the end of the show, but be back after the break with another great topic. Chris, in today's digital age, your online reputation, as we all know, is crucial. With customers relying on online reviews, your first impression is also compared directly with your competitors.
Sure is. And Reed, consider this. 86% of patients today read online reviews, and 73% demand that that healthcare provider has a minimum 4-star rating.
Demand. They demand it.
Yeah, they do.
Well, to stand out, choose reputation to help amplify your brand and to build trust. Be the provider of choice in your area, understand patient sentiment, get actionable insights, and even foster patient loyalty.
And look, here's the easy way you could do that. All you need to do is go visit reputation.com/touchpoint. That's reputation.com/touchpoint, where you can download their healthcare online reputation management guide and build a reputation that performs for you. Another 3-letter acronym we're going to tackle today. This is becoming a regular thing in our library here of podcasts dedicated to TLAs, 3-letter acronyms.
A 3-letter acronym of 3-letter acronyms.
Yeah. That's right.
That's good.
That's right.
That's good.
That's right. I like yeah. that. Today, we're going to be talking about digital experience platforms. We've been hearing this term a lot lately, haven't we?
Yes. I probably use some terminology and terms incorrectly. I'm almost positive I do. And so I talk about like consumer experience platforms and things like that. But yeah, so DXPs.
CXPs are closely related, by the way. If you create your DXP focused on the consumer, it is a consumer experience platform, or it could be, right? If you think about it.
Yep.
But let's talk a little bit about digital experience platforms. And we have a great interview later in the show with John Burnt from Valtech, who's going to be talking about one of the principles or frameworks that's going to be very helpful if you're creating a digital experience platform, and that is composability. Stay tuned for that. But let's first jump in, Reed, and do what we always like to do is whenever we introduce a term that may be new to others that are listening in, let's kind of try to define it a little bit. And we found a great article from an organization that actually does a lot of consulting around digital. No surprise, they have a platform or a position on this. LifeRay is the name of the company. They wrote an article called "What is a Digital Experience Platform?" Sounds like a good one for us to kind of hit some of the high notes here.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and we'll kind of dig in here a little bit, but you know, really the crux of it, just to cut to it, is they say that most of these products are positioned around the idea of what we've looked at historically, which are like content management systems, maybe portals. If you've got some sort of an e-commerce scenario, things like that, right? Like that's kind of the foundational elements of a DXP. So again, just as you're kind of trying to orient yourself a little bit.
Yeah. And we have talked about this time and again on this show about how people using or interacting with us digitally, they do it through multiple different channels. You know, obviously, I think we all feel that a website's an important part of this, but it's not just websites. It's social media, mobile devices, other ways that they're going to interact with you that's maybe not even within your own managed environment. All of this is kind of the concept, if you think about it all together, as a digital experience platform.
Yeah, and even more holistically, right? And that's why the word experience is in there, I guess. And we've talked a little bit about the consumer's expectation and things like that over the months. And they call out in here the idea that, you know, that people expect it to be, you know, something like Google or Apple or Facebook or Amazon or whatever it may be. You know, how do you create and how do you have the infrastructure in place to create experiences more holistically? Yeah, that's really where this is leading.
Digital experience platforms are a little bit hard to define. Like, we can't have a checklist of all the different products that are in there, but it's really around the experience platform. But what we like about this article is it actually kind of positions DXPs as having three categorical roots from which they've grown, where this concept has grown. And we're going to jump into each one of these. And as we do, we're going to try to overlay that concept to what we see in health systems and hospitals across the country that we've worked with. So the first one is this concept of digital experience platforms that came from what this article calls a CMS heritage. Mm. They grew from a content management system or a website. And most of the CMS heritage DXPs focus on the needs of what marketing and creative agencies typically do. They collect data. That data collection tends to be anonymous and generalized into audience segmentations. Many of the problems that they're trying to solve through this DXP is around acquisition of customers or a branding awareness, that kind of thing, facilitating transactions. Particularly in B2C scenarios, CMS heritage DXPs work really well. They have a strong offering for web-based analytics, segmentation, integration with advertising and email campaigns, and those sorts of things. They kind of are built around the CMS itself. So CMS heritage DXPs are really a CMS is at the core, and all these other experience services are built around it. Kind of makes sense. And I think a lot of health system websites, as we think about digital front doors, a lot of that is like taking a CMS and starting to build experiences around it.
100%. I think this 9 times out of 10, if you kind of had a conversation with somebody about a digital experience platform, they're going to base their responses, their answers, their experiences kind of probably from this CMS heritage, at least in our space, right? People we know, kind of the CMS baked world. That's kind of how we think about it more often than not. The other one they call out here, another one they call out here, I should say, is a portal kind of background, portal heritage. And so I think when we say portal, everybody immediately thinks of something really specific in healthcare. So again, these days, you know, you think about your EHR, Epic, Cerner, Allscripts, whatever it may be, Meditech even, some of the app-based workflows there. So I think MyChart is built around loyalty, retention, renewal. Like, we know who you are. I think that's kind of an interesting caveat here. One thing they call out is the intranet, right? Or workplace scenarios being kind of in this world, which is kind of interesting. I hadn't really thought about that. As I see and read the word portal, it makes me think of patient portal. But again, workplace, and kind of work style or cohort based maybe experiences. And so again, when you're looking at metrics, this is where things like net promoter score. So again, think about loyalty come into play. There's usually a lot of integrations. They've got deep, they say, transformation into the business operations. So more of a portal based vantage point.
Right. So I obviously think of like EMRs, right? And patient portals as being like from this world. And you and I spend a lot of time looking at how do we take people from a website, which is a different type of audience sometimes, and make it seamless to the back end portal based DXP, the My Charts and other things like that. That's kind of an interesting nuance there. And there's different strategies that you could take, right? Portal heritage DXPs look at content management, targeting, workflow, a lot of transactional stuff. But then there's a third flavor of DXP that comes from a commerce world. Mm. This is when we start talking about like online shopping scenarios. It's a lot of e-commerce web interactions, really looking at inventory management, shopping carts, payment integrations, checkout fulfillment, those kinds of features. This article kind of puts forward that they aren't strictly related to digital experience management, but a good digital experience requires integration with these functions. And oftentimes this commerce heritage DXP, particularly in healthcare, is sort of the bridge between the front end CMS focused DXPs and the back end portal DXPs. It's like taking a new customer and converting them to an existing customer. So it kind of plays that role in between. It's kind of an interesting viewpoint to see the spectrum of what DXPs can be.
It's almost just kind of depending on who you ask, right? Like what vendor, what solution, what partner, what colleague. I don't know that there's a real wrong answer necessarily. But again, just trying to give some context on how the world's evolving. I think for most of us and probably most people listening, you know, you're making the leap from a content management system or a CMS to a DXP. Like that's probably the most logical kind of talk track here would be my guess.
Or you can create a DXP platform that integrates on top of it, right? It doesn't have to be a CMS. We're going to, after the break, we're going to talk a little bit about DXPs and how they differ from a CMS, even though many of them are rooted in a CMS. But the last thought on this is that when you're in a healthcare organization, DXP platforms have to have operational and marketing capabilities so that even if you start with a digital marketing experience, like people discover you through a digital front door or what have you, you won't have to go through an entirely different technology approach or vendor selection to choose a DXP for your portal environment. Ideally, you're looking for kind of that bridge between both worlds, so to speak.
I think kind of going into this idea of, yes, it is an evolution from a CMS to a DXP, but really, what does that mean? And we'll talk more about that right after the break.
Coming soon from Greystone, Bowstring, and Touchpoint Media, live from HCIC, a new podcast that brings you front row access to the latest innovative strategies that are shaping tomorrow's healthcare industry. In this 12-part series, as recorded live at the Healthcare Internet Conference, we'll hear from industry experts such as Paul Mattson of the Cleveland Clinic, Kathy Smith of Roper St. Francis Healthcare, David Feinberg from Mount Sinai Health System, Rose Glenn from Michigan Medicine, and many others. Subscribe now on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, or your favorite podcasting platform. This podcast series is brought to you by Greystone.net, Bowstring, and Touchpoint Media.
So content management systems, they still exist, right?
Yeah.
That's still a thing?
Yeah, oh yeah.
Okay. I was just making sure. I don't know. I just, you know, maybe we don't use that term anymore. I don't know.
Maybe it's a channel like in your DXP, right? Your CMS, your website is an important tool, just as is text messaging and advertising and all the other digital tools in your toolkit. But a lot of people confuse the two terms together. They think CMS is just really a DXP, and a DXP is a better way to say content management system. That's not necessarily true, right?
No, it's not. And we've got an article here we'll kind of reference and of course, link to from Sitecore, very popular content management system in the healthcare space. They talk about a content management system being what powers the organization's website. So again, everybody's going to go, yeah, no. That's what I was thinking. And the tools needed to deliver on that content, right? So you got the editorial piece, some of the workflows, you know, permission-based pieces, there's some reporting potentially, all that kind of fun stuff, right? Like how you can execute against visually what people see about your organization online. However, a DXP, broader, full sets of tools, how do we deliver on that personalized experience across channels, languages, et cetera. And they talk in here about the fact that the two can overlap. I think they have to overlap, right? Not they can. I don't know that they're different, honestly. And again, I guess that's maybe, we can argue a little bit here, but like, I think we've moved from a CMS to a DXP. I think you can still go get a CMS. Like I think they still exist.
Yeah, they still do.
I mean, you can go download WordPress, right? And it's a content management system and stand it up and you have an online brochure. Really, what we're talking about as an industry is a DXP. We may be saying CMS, though, I guess is my point.
Yeah, so let's talk about CMS, right? Your website, content management system. It's your website and all the applications related to the website. It's content, the workflow, all that stuff that you talked about. Some organizations also have additional tools kind of plugged into their CMS, security and compliance. You know, this is where we're getting into, do you have a data privacy layer? How are you keeping track of the data, going way past the HTTPS environment? But like, you know, how are you handling user data? And you have security first CMSs as well. A lot of that's really built into many of the different CMS platforms that are out there. There's also workflow management, which is kind of like a CMS where you can have like this whole workflow around authoring, editing, staging, approving, et cetera. Some CMSs can now deliver to multiple channels. Like you could have content that you publish on your website that can also then publish into an email, for example, to create a newsletter, dynamic newsletter. There's also multi-site capabilities where you can actually have multiple different presentations of your website. You can even do it in multiple different languages if done right. This is all still CMS-related stuff. Cloud hosting, that's a big thing of this. Publishing is a modern CMS. Even having shopping carts can be part of a CMS. So by this definition, it sounds a lot like a CMS could be considered a DXP. But there's other factors of a DXP that are a lot different than what we just talked about, right?
It does. And I think, again, I think the crux of this a little bit, I don't want to oversimplify, but we're talking about the fact that the CMS supports content relative to this digital experience. Where a DXP goes beyond that, they say in this article here, by providing automation and smart delivery across websites, portals, apps, IoT devices, et cetera. So I guess the idea is it's stretching more broadly than just this idea of the website, maybe, or even mobile apps and things like that. And could even, as we talk more and more about some of the machine learning, large language models, all the AI pieces, you know, that kind of dovetails in here as well.
Yeah, like chatbots and all this other stuff. Suddenly you're in a world where you have all this other capabilities to enhance the experience, Reed. Think about like the marketing tools that could be part of a DXP. Personalization, asset management, digital asset management, digital processes, data centers, CRM integration, master data management initiatives. All of these things are all part of a great digital experience platform, which can be plugged right into a CMS or could be built on top of a CMS if it's truly a DXP in this particular case. So what we're really talking about is, yeah, is your website still a website? Well, it's actually evolving to become a digital experience platform, particularly if you're doing some of the work that you and I are doing.
Yes, absolutely. It's not that, I want to be careful here, it's not that the content's not important, but to what extent, short of a few really well-known logos around the industry, understand the intent here, the spirit in which I'm saying this, maybe you, the listener, people are not researching on most of our websites. And I want to make a distinction here. I'm not saying they don't read stuff that's on your website, but it's more from a confirmation standpoint. Like, do they do this? Like, what exactly do they do? You know what I'm saying? They're not necessarily researching per se. It's more transactional in nature, more than ever. So scheduling, you mentioned chatbots, getting questions answered, all the DIY components. That's really where a lot of this is headed, and really kind of where the DXP ultimately delivers on this value versus it being solely about content. Again, content's so important. Not saying it's not. Be real clear. But really, people are coming to your website, or maybe even coming to your website, right? I mean, they may not be leaving the search result page, but they're trying to transact. They want to do something.
Before we wrap up our part of the show and go to the interview from John Byrne, let's touch on really quickly, read another article called The Evolution of the CMS to a Digital Experience Platform, because that's really what we're talking about here. And right away, what you just talked about, static content is not the core of your DXP. The services, the transactions, the actionable content and engagement should be, right? That's what it all should be here. But that's not all. It's also content personalization. Different audiences have different needs. So being able to understand your customer, that's where you talk about, you know, having a CDP or a consumer data platform to be able to understand who's accessing it. Or if you're creating an intranet, to understand your different persona types that are going to be using it from your employees. And along with personalization comes the whole privacy and the privacy and data security layer, of course, that we all struggle with in healthcare. That's a big part of it. But there's some other characteristics or things, milestones that you kind of have to hit to get there, right?
Yeah, and I mentioned one of them a minute ago, which is kind of this DIY or the self-service piece. You know, creating things that allow for optimization, meaning, you know, you don't have to have a human in the middle of every answer, every step, every, you know, purchasing decision, so to speak, is a big piece of that.
And then lastly, I think we all heard about when we're doing websites, we hear about like templates and components, like the building blocks of a website are the page templates and the components. The whole concept here is that if you have templates and components and it's built on top of a digital experience platform where you can render up content, let's say provider data or location data, you could then just feed this dynamic content into a standard template or component and create various different experiences on the fly, right? These low-code, no-code website ideas come from this whole concept of you build what you need to build using the content that's powering it in a personalized way. That's a digital experience platform. That's how you move your CMS to a DXP. But there's one other concept here, Reed, that I think is really, really important. And that I recently, when I sat down with John Byrne from Valtech, he and I talked about, and it's this concept of composability.
Mm.
So after the break, we'll come back and you'll hear the conversation I had with John Byrne about how a composable architecture is critical for a DXP. And he goes a little bit into defining what that is and why that is. And we'll do that right after this pause.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
We're back with the Ask the Expert segment, and today I'm excited to have back on the show a friend, colleague, and that's my friend John Byrne. Welcome to the show.
Great to be here, Chris. Thanks for having me back.
I'm excited that you're on. It's been way too long since your last time, and I'm really excited about today's topic because you're going to help me understand completely this term that a lot of people are using. But before we get started, John, I'd love for you to share a little bit about your background for those few people who don't know you and what you're doing at Valtech.
Sure, I'd love to tell you. So I have about 33 years in digital. I was a first generation internet entrepreneur when Mosaic Browser came out. Today, I run the healthcare vertical, which is pharmaceuticals, consumer healthcare, and medical devices and supplies for the Americas for Baltech, which is a great digital transformation agency that does work in a lot of different areas, but is particularly focused on healthcare. And in that role, I have general responsibility for making sure that the practice is sophisticated as possible, and then directly work with clients and so forth.
Well, I think bringing sophistication to your practice is one thing that you're really good at, because one thing I do know from our conversations, they tend to be very in-depth as well as very technical and overall sophisticated in the concepts. So, and that kind of leads us nicely to this conversation today. Reed and I have been talking about, you know, how the websites are evolving to really become a critical part of the digital experience platform. There's this concept that you and I have talked about in the past. And I want to kind of drill in a little bit on it. But before we jump into composable DXP, give us your perspective on, is the website evolving to become a digital experience platform, or is it just now part of the digital experience platform?
Well, I think there's definitely been an evolution, and I would say it's a decade in at this point, from where folks were primarily focused on websites as like sources of official public content and as marketing vehicles, to the web being a really important channel in a much broader universe of channels. And the challenge of that, especially in healthcare, usually sort of moderately sized marketing teams are trying to get a lot done across a lot of channels and kind of synchronize and orchestrate things that they're doing across different channels together. And they really need to leverage technology to do that. And so the traditional sort of monolithic website platforms that, you know, dominated healthcare and corporate websites, you know, in many cases, they did lots of great things, but they weren't necessarily the right tools for every job. So this issue of composable DXP comes up because people hit the limitations a lot of those platforms and ended up having to buy a lot of redundant technology. And the tricky part was, if you were working in a lot of kind of parallel silos of technology that never touched, that then really put a lot of strain on, you know, things operationally and on the humans that were trying to get the work done. So there's been a need for a sort of more flexible and more streamlined way of doing it. And I think the websites are still probably at the core in a lot of ways, but there's certainly many, many other important channels that also absolutely need a lot of attention.
It kind of brings to mind then, what is this concept of composable DXP? Whenever I hear the term composable, in my mind, I already immediately flash forward to like you're creating an environment where you have a lot of Lego building blocks putting it together, but maybe that's too simplified of a perspective on that.
Yeah, in this context, in platforms in general, composability is a sort of term that's emerged that implies that there's an expectation that the platforms are not monolithic, meaning not necessarily all from one vendor or one piece of software that you install, and that they are furthermore built in such a way that they are meant to interoperate with other things. Hmm. So, you know, in the past, people might say, well, that's always been that way. I always had a CRM that had nothing to do with my CMS, you know, and so forth. But that's not what composability is. Composability is when you have something like, you know, a component that handles aspects of customer data, personalization that is fit to purpose for what you actually need, but it can actually interact with and talk with what you use to manage content. And that in turn, you know, can talk to another system that handles, you know, different aspects of delivery of that content through websites. And the overall concept of composability is that you're trying to really up the flexibility and not have people just tied to a single vendor's roadmap or what a single vendor specializes in, but to be able to have the best of both worlds, use best of breed components for the different things that they need to do, and then have a solution that kind of works really well that combines all of those components together.
Yeah, but that's not to say that there are CMS vendors that have built composable architectures as well. We're not just saying that you're now going from one to many. it could be a combination thereof.
Right? I would say it's a trend of the last maybe 4 years or 5 years or so that the major monolithic DXP or CMS, depending on which acronym you prefer, vendors have tried to go towards composability. And so a lot of the major vendors that people run their websites off of in healthcare are building things in ways that are more composable. Like, for instance, there are, you know, vendors that have very good personalization or customer data modules that are intended to work with their CMS, but can really be used with any CMS and vice versa. That is a general trend. And those vendors are now in the mix in composability as well. The tricky part is that not all those vendors have done an equal job of making their composable elements work, you know, as neutrally with other third parties as others. And some of them are more meant to be used that way than not. So when people are thinking about putting together a composable architecture for their digital experience, they have to kind of look under the hood on all of those things and see, you know, is it a marketing thing that it's composable, or is it really part of a you know, this move towards this greater flexibility for marketers about what technology they use?
In my career, I kind of stepped the line between the strategy side of the house and dipping my toe into the technology side of the house. There's some other related terms that I've heard in this that might be related to this concept of composability, which is like headless, building headless environments or being an API-driven environment. Help clarify for us, like, how do these things fit within this model of composability?
I would say one of the things that drove the composable revolution in DXP was that the way that traditional DXPs operated for a very long time, back to the, you know, early 2000s, was that they would manage the content and the sort of sequence of content, the experience of websites on the back end, but they would also have a front end, which is called the head in the parlance of the industry, that would actually present the website and make the website visible. And over time, there were a couple problems that really built up around the way that that was engineered in the kind of mainstream DXP platforms. One thing was that the actual cost of hosting all of the front ends of large websites got to be very, very expensive, because the way the systems were architected, the thing that made your website visible was a whole giant software platform. And you had to have multiple hosted versions of that across multiple servers. So the cost of just the actual hosting footprint was very high. Second thing was, for all that cost, you didn't really get great performance. And you especially didn't get great performance around personalized elements on pages. In a way, if you imagine, you know, some curves on a graph, there was like web traffic going up, the importance of websites going up, and the ability of those systems to actually handle traffic and be cost effective going down at the same time. So, you know, the industry was primed for disruption. So people began to focus on a couple things. They began to focus on JavaScript as a kind of new lingua franca language for both backend and front-end web applications. And that was a pretty disruptive cultural trend. And that, combined with this idea of headless delivery, which meant that you wouldn't have the DXP platform being the thing that was the final step between the experience and the consumer. You would have something else. That something else was a new kind of hosting called edge delivery, which grew out of content delivery networks. Those were networks that had previously been used to accelerate websites that you could sort of put on top of your website to accelerate websites. One day, all those companies woke up and realized that they could also host websites as long as they didn't host anything that was like an application that you would need AWS or Azure for. And so headless hosting was born, and it was cheaper, but it was also many, many times faster. And the way that speeded things up also really helped people's Google scores. It was a big SEO boon. So there was immediately this huge value proposition of, if I can move to headless hosting, I'm going to have a much better experience. It's going to be much faster. My SEO is probably going to go up. And there started to be ways, techniques of incorporating personalized content into that so that the personalized content wouldn't be slower than the default content. So all that made for a much better experience. It also drove this idea of componentization that would then, you know, become composability so that you would have, you know, for instance, a CMS that really just only managed the content. It really would be a content management system, and it wouldn't actually be the thing that made the website visible. There'd be another layer for that. And then the personalization might be yet another component. And it started to allow people to think more about breaking things up because they were stepping out of this monolithic architecture that had, you know, dominated CMS since the early 2000s.
As you're describing it, John, you're sharing a lot of terms that makes me start to realize the value of embracing this model. First of all, you said it's inexpensive to host. It allows for more personalization. But I'd love to hear from you, you know, a little bit more about where you see the business value of adopting a composable DXP framework.
So I would say at the top of the list is if you do composable right, you are not stuck within any one vendor's roadmap. And it's a sort of truism that, you know, although there are some very great vendors out there, no software vendor is really going to be able to be good at all the complex things that are needed for really good digital ecosystems. People always end up using multiple vendors. And so there's a lot of waste in that people used to buy a monolithic CMS, but only use maybe 70% of what it was sold as doing, because the other 30% just wasn't sophisticated enough for their needs. That general principle extends much farther if you really want to have excellence in your digital practice, because you can now actually use best of breed components for all the things you need to do. Like, you're not stuck with the customer data approach of vendor X just because you like the way that they manage content. So if you do composable right, you really are able to sort of really raise the bar of the operational excellence, efficiency, capability of your digital operation. That's the first thing. A second thing, which is very related to that in the idea of composability, is it's another thing that potentially helps get you out of the idea of this kind of apocalyptic redesign every 5 years of your ecosystem, which was very much driven by the technology turnover of versions of the monolithic platforms. And one piece of the monolithic platform would get too old, too long in the tooth. The whole platform would have to be turned over. That's when you would do a redesign. You would redesign everything at once. There are a couple problems with that. First of all, there was immense waste and inefficiency in that process. But the other issue was it also distracted people from the ongoing and ate the budgets that would help people with their ongoing improvements. So with composability, you know, if your content management part of your composable solution is itself needing to be upgraded, that doesn't mean everything else has to change. And it doesn't mean it needs to force a redesign. So from just a nuts and bolts business perspective, it just opens up a lot more opportunities, and people can, in composability, move different pieces in and out as they find a better solution. Like realizing you have a new business need, changing what customer data platform you use as a part of your composable solution would be an example of that. So hopefully getting people beyond the sort of catastrophic redesign and into more of an ongoing improvements, you know, kind of a Kaizen continuous improvement approach to the digital ecosystem that costs much less money to achieve. And then from there, you kind of go down into the trenches of things like SEO, which everybody really cares about, or just having the snappiest possible customer experience, or can I really have personalized content rendering on my pages at the same, you know, relatively the same speed as the default content? Those are all things that, you know, are made possible by this approach that were much harder to achieve or really expensive to achieve before.
Well, that's, you know, as you describe it, I could see it potentially has a lot of value to organizations when they start to approach this. But you kept quantifying that, right? It says when you do composable DXP the correct way. So that to me speaks to the fact that this is not easy and there are potential, you know, challenges with embracing this. It isn't like you can just buy composable and suddenly everything's interoperable.
And you had asked the question before about, you mentioned headless, and I kind of went off on a tangent about headless, but you also mentioned APIs, and part of composability is this idea of API, things being API first, which means that a really large percentage of what the software component does, let's say it's a content management component or a customer data component, it can be accessed through, you know, application programming interfaces, APIs. And the more of those that you have and the better that they're done, the higher performing they are and the more technically robust they are, the more you can create very custom solutions that really leverage the full value of the software. That is what a central piece of composability that makes it possible is, that all these platforms have all of those connections, you know, available and open. So when you talk about sort of doing composable right versus, you know, some of the possible challenges, I do think that having a kind of composable ecosystem, it does tend to shift more responsibility ultimately away from a single software vendor onto the adopters of the system, and, you know, let's say they're knowledgeable consultants, to make good choices and to understand how all the pieces fit together. And you could argue that, you know, that sounds scary, but some of the monolithic platforms have not always had the best track record of taking that responsibility themselves. It's not as giant a jump as one might think in some ways. But it does have some really big implications for healthcare and other regulated industries. And I want to talk about that in a second. But just more generally, the nature of the solution that you're producing is not one that has a single software vendor behind it. So there isn't, you know, so to speak, one throat to choke if you are building a solution where your CDP comes from company X, your content management system comes from company Y, you're building, you know, the website is being rendered through a, let's say, a Next.js headless application that renders it into this very fast hosting. And that's something that's being built on some framework that's not owned by anybody. You might end up with six or seven pieces in a composable solution, and they have to all be picked to be the right ones. So it puts a little bit more pressure on not listening to necessarily marketing and salespeople, but really doing a deep dive, you know, probably with knowledgeable consultants to figure out for your specific digital operations and business needs, what are the right pieces that you should be bringing together to do this? And then thinking about how they might evolve over time is also good. And if they're not built for composability, they can't really be in your selection set.
As you outline that, it really reinforces the fact that if you're going down this path, you have to assess the entire ecosystem of what APIs, what other platforms in your technology stack, not just your MarTech stack, are going to interoperate with your DXP. And that really speaks to building out a cohesive strategy, kind of support that.
And like with any technology adoption, the thing people always forget about technology adoption is that to a greater or lesser extent, with any technology you adopt in this realm, you really do need to think of it as building a practice around that stuff. Like you can't adopt a customer data platform without building a practice around it. So you need your roadmap to include the sort of human factors of who's going to be the expert in this and, you know, how is that going to map to people's roles and so forth and so on. I mean, honestly, none of this would be happening if there wasn't a lot of pressure from the real needs of marketers and real needs of organizations and the digital consumer pressure that we're all under to actually do a better job and have a, you know, better overall solutions that really where every, you know, it's not just that some of the pieces work and are good, but that all the pieces work and are good. And also that we don't have to have these apocalyptic redesigns on a 5-year schedule, but we can actually
Right.
be working on stuff in an ongoing way. And when technology, you know, dies or times out, we don't have to get rid of all of it. We can just get rid of that one piece and swap something else in. So that's the magic of it.
You and I have worked together in the health system provider space. I'm wondering how composable DXP is kind of cascading to the other lines of the healthcare industry that you're working with, like pharma, consumer health, med devices. Are they approaching it in a similar way?
There are some fairly important differences between those different subsectors of healthcare and how these solutions play out. And I'll try to simplify what's a kind of a complicated matter just to give the flavor of it. But definitely, if you're in one of those spaces and you're thinking about adopting composable DXP, a deeper dive investigation is warranted. There's sort of two major angles that need to be looked at. One is the needs of digital operations and how those needs tend to be different between different areas in healthcare. And the other is a sort of regulatory concerns. And so let's start with digital operations. So with digital operations, it's generally true that within these composable solutions, if we're talking about, you know, kind of the website side of things, it is possible to do all the same stuff that the mature monolithic platforms of yesteryear could do. But I would say if you're doing a headless composable solution, the experience of managing large bespoke sort of Byzantine tree structures, like you might get in a large institutional academic medicine website, is going to be a little bit more difficult if your back end is, you know, Contentful or Content Stack and your front end is a custom Next.js application that's then rendering out the website. It just doesn't have the same thoroughgoing usability today. Maybe in a year or so we'll get there. But as of today, it's a little bit of a step back in some of those efficiencies. And the same thing is true with circumstances where you have to do a lot, not just a little, but a lot of ad hoc page creation using ad hoc components on your pages. So if you're doing like a ton of landing pages and they all have to have a different layout and you want to do that in your DXP solution, you can still do that, but it is not as clean an experience as the former historic platforms will give you. That said, there is a lot less of a need for that from my experience in areas like retail medicine, like large, you know, very optimized retail medicine organizations, in some parts of pharma and in many medical device companies and supply companies. Things are driven a lot more by very streamlined categorization, and there is a lot of self-similarity in the way things are built. If you're doing a lot of like creative work with sitemaps that are driven maybe by a mixture of politics and usability, and you're doing a lot of work with, you know, bespoke page development, just where you're dragging different components onto pages, that stuff may make you want to look at this in a different way, because it is not as streamlined. But what you're getting in exchange for that slight step backwards in the usability of those features is dramatic speed improvements, as well as better security, as well as usually better SEO. So, you know, it's a balance in terms of how that works. That's dimension one, is the digital operations dimension. Dimension two is regulatory. You know, all of healthcare, you know, especially in the US, has a lot of regulation. Obviously, there's very different regulation in pharma and in consumer health, because in consumer health, health insurers, health systems, retail medicine, et cetera, you're dealing with, you know, the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act, aka HIPAA of 1996, that adds a particular level of intensity to the regulatory concerns. When you're working with a composable architecture, it puts a lot of pressure in all of healthcare to have a baseline understanding of how the different components are interacting with those regulatory considerations. Which components are actually taking in data that might potentially be viewed as patient healthcare information governed under HIPAA? Is the process by which I publish my pharma website going to meet the review standards and control standards that are necessary for, you know, marketing in pharmaceuticals. So those kinds of considerations really map to whatever your solution is. It's like you said earlier in the conversation, you're building your solution out of these different Legos. They all play together technically, but where do the regulatory concerns map? And to some extent, that's a very different discussion in Composable than it is in the previous era of monolithic platforms, because there the question was, is the monolithic platform compliant? But if you're building your own and there's no single software company behind it, you need to make sure that to the extent it matters for those flows of protected information or review processes or whatever it is, that all the components that are involved that you've picked separately have the right level of compliance, or in some cases are willing to sign business associate agreements, like, you know, where, you know, for instance, a customer data platform would have to sign one of those in order to have any HIPAA related information pass through it, and so forth and so on. So it makes the process of sort of certifying your overall solution a little bit more complicated in healthcare. And for that reason, you have to, you know, approach that selection process and the composition of the solution, really looking at that, not just the technical aspects, but also the legal aspects.
There is a lot involved here, but it definitely sounds like spending a little time on the strategy, which we've often said in our space, John, over the years, right? Putting that effort into really understanding what you're trying to build and grow is going to be critical for you, regardless of what industry you're in. And I also tend to say here now, we've seen this trend happening definitely in health systems, what we're seeing, probably seeing this in other parts of the industry. It's no longer a marketing technology stack. It's just an enterprise-wide technology stack that we have to consider as part of this approach.
And as you know, correctly pointed out at the beginning of the conversation, we're not just talking about the website channel. When people are building these ecosystems and adopting these composable solutions, they are doing things like, you know, rendering things other than the website out to the super fast edge hosting so that they can use those assets in, you know, all different other, you know, sort of digital multi-channel, omni-channel strategies. So the technology stack, you know, is intentionally usually broader than just thinking about web activity. Now, there are parts of it that are very specific to web activity. Like usually there is a purely web content management layer, but it's getting a lot of its content from other places. And then usually there is a process by which some variations get made to content to make them ready for those other channels, like social channels, email, you know, other places that they're being sent. It's a broader mandate, you know, and you also have the orchestration layer of, you know, which personalization did I show somebody off of this channel? You know, how does that affect the next thing they see in the next channel where they encounter my organization? Those kinds of things can be sort of centrally orchestrated as well.
I think this is really an interesting in-depth conversation, John. What else haven't we talked about regarding this that people listening in might want to know about?
You know, actually, I just have one sort of final comment, which I think has been kicking around in my own head as I've been, you know, over the last several years, you know, broadening out and still very much a fan of a lot of the monolithic platforms and still very involved with a lot of the monolithic platforms. And they really do. There are use cases where they really are the best thing. But thinking about what I hear you reacting to, which is the complexity of a true composable solution. I mean, it's one thing to go to a monolithic platform that's now doing composable and just buy all their stuff and it all works together. And in some ways that is an improvement over the previous era, but true composability is where, you know, you really do have the option that 75% of it comes from one vendor, but 25% of it comes from another. And it all still works together and it's totally viable and you get a lot more business value as a result. So that sounds really complicated and there is some complexity, especially on the, you know, the upfront of making the choices of really, you know, where to place your bets with which technology vendors. But the thing that's been bouncing around in my head as I've been going through this journey for the last couple of years with various healthcare clients is that it's more complicated in a way, but that's because it's closer to reality. What's also really complicated is explaining to your boss why you bought this very expensive platform and you can't really use the personalization because it's too slow. Or you bought this huge platform and because none of it can be HIPAA compliant, you have to throw it all out. And so composability is the solution to that problem, which in a lot of ways is, you know, to the extent people are paying attention, is a much bigger problem. And I would say people are paying more attention now than they ever have before, because we're so deep into the game of the digital experience is the experience that matters.
Those are really good words, really strong words to have, because we are in an environment where we are facing so many different confluxes of pressures on our business. Going down the composable route is a long but important process to follow, but it does move you away from the checkbox of we have a website to now we have a strategy, a digital strategy that can grow with us and continue to allow us to be best in breed, regardless of our environment.
And in many cases, it means that the components that are being chosen are more robust than what a website-only platform would have provided or come up.
Great conversation. I always love how technically geeky we get. It scratches an itch for me. I love that. You have some great expertise. If people listening in, they want to learn a little bit more about you, what are some ways they could do that?
Well, LinkedIn is probably the best place to go. That's where I live most of the day. I'm also john.berndt, B-E-R-N-D-T, at Valtech, V-A-L-T-E-C-H.com.
And you tend to show up at these healthcare conferences that we're at typically, right? Will you be in Vegas in April?
I will be. I will be in Vegas hoping to see my friend Chris Boyer out there. And also at HCIC and at Pharma East and a whole bunch of others. So, yeah.
That's awesome. Well, we'll definitely make sure that if you're listening in to find some time to find John and the other great people at Valtech and talk further about this. So, John, thank you again for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you so much for having me, Chris. It's always a delight to talk to you, and I hope we do it again soon.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Special thanks to John for coming back on the show. He's been on a number of times over the course of the last 6-7 years. So always excited to have him on, hear kind of his thoughts and some of his technical acumen as it relates to, you know, all these topics around DXPs and otherwise. So very cool. Appreciate him. Look forward to seeing him. Right? Is he coming to Vegas?
He will. He'll be there in Vegas at HMPS along with you and I. And we're going to be there, Reed, in spades. You're going to be in a panel that I'm going to be moderating about the changing role of the digital leader in healthcare. I'm also going to be doing a pre-conference workshop on AI and a lot about AI governance. All the things that we've talked about on the show, I'm going to be with a panel of people that we're going to talk about AI and how they're introducing AI to their health systems and talking through the path that they've gone down. And then I'm also going to be doing a fireside chat about artificial intelligence on the first day. It's actually the kickoff of the conference. So, it's in Reed, you're going to be in there a lot as well.
Right? I am. Yeah, I'll be there the whole time. Be up on stage a couple different times, like you mentioned, Chris. And so, looking forward to it. Talking about the evolving role of digital, obviously, and a few other things. So, it should be fun. Always a good time. Good to see folks, John and otherwise. So, hopefully you can make it.
Absolutely. We look forward to seeing you there. By the way, we're going to record an episode of the Touchpoint podcast there. So reach out to us if you would like to be part of that recording.
Well, before we wrap up the show, maybe a couple of recommendations. What do you got today?
Reed, I'm going to recommend a board game. It's called Taco versus Burrito.
Taco versus Burrito. Okay.
It's a card game, and it's actually a pretty straightforward card game. It's not really a taco fighting a burrito, even though that's what's on the cover. This game was created by a 7-year-old. You're either building a taco or you're building a burrito. It doesn't matter. They don't really compete against each other. It's just whatever your preference is. I personally like to be a taco, but if you like burritos, you could be a burrito. You're dealt cards, and you decide to either put ingredients into your taco or burrito, or you could put other cards in other people's tacos or burritos. And those cards, they're called tummy ache cards, and they basically take points away. It's basically a card counting, you know, point game.
Okay.
And then you have action cards. Action cards can do other things. Like, for example, you could play a health inspector card against one of the people building a burrito or a taco, and then all the contents of their taco or burrito go in the trash because the health inspector rejected it, and they have to start again. It's really kind of fun. It's easy to play. It's for ages 6 to, as they say on the box, 106. We played it with a bunch of friends. It's funny. It's hilarious. And it's really like a great game to play if you're sitting around the table being social with others, if you know what I mean.
Nicely done. But
it's called Taco versus Burrito. It's a really fun game. I recommend it for anybody who likes to do board games.
Very, very cool. I am going to recommend a TV show. I have started watching, for the first time, actually, The West Wing. Did you watch this?
Years ago, yeah.
It's just kind of fun to watch. One, it's a good show. I think it was well done. And people seem to like it, critical acclaim and whatnot. But it's old enough now that it's a little bit nostalgic and kind of just fun to watch because it's just an old TV show. I mean, we're not talking about Andy Griffith here, but it is a little bit funny as it relates to like phones and fax machines and like, I mean, just different artifacts, you know, that you kind of see through the show that are such a big deal. So anyway, I'm recommending, maybe it's The West Wing, maybe it's something else, but find a series that's on one of these streaming services now and go back and watch it. It's oddly comforting.
Good actors in it too. Allison Janney, Rob Lowe is in it.
Yeah.
Martin Sheen, right? Really great actors. And it's back when you watch it, it's almost nostalgic for the time when politics and what your idea of like the West Wing, the presidential suite, is like, right? A lot different than what the current tenor and timber of politics is today. I don't want to get too political, but I really like that show. And it happens to be my wife's favorite television program.
It's kind of fun. And again, it could be something else, you know, but if you find something from the 90s to like the early 2000s, it's kind of fun to go back and watch. So, all right, folks. Well, hey, great episode, great content. Looking forward to seeing everybody here in just a few weeks. Reach out. LinkedIn's probably the best way to do that. Let us know if you're going to be there or if you've got an idea for the show. We would certainly appreciate that as well. Rate, review, subscribe, all that kind of fun stuff. For Chris Boyer, I'm Reed Smith, and we'll see you next week.
This has been a Touchpoint Media production. To learn more about this show and others like it, please visit us online at touchpoint.health.